Hello, everyone. This is your host, Manoj Tandon, with another episode of Dark Rhino Security, Security Confidential. Today, we have someone who is very well known in cybersecurity joining us, Mr. Tom Esten. Tom's got a fantastic background, over 17 years in cybersecurity. He's been a frequent speaker at many different user groups, international cybersecurity conferences. You might have seen him at Black Hat, at DEF CON, at DerbyCon, at SANS, InfoSec World. He has really put his knowledge out there. He's done a lot of penetration testing, red teaming. You know, he's a huge security and privacy advocate. We're honored to have him on the show. Tom, thank you for doing this. Thanks for coming and giving us a little bit of your afternoon here.
Wow, I'm truly honored. So thank you for having me on your show. This is great. Really looking forward to the conversation today.
So I got to ask you, since you yourself are a podcaster, how does it feel to be on the other side of this mic right now and not be asking the questions?
I love it. I like being in the hot seat. This is kind of fun, right? People asking me questions, it kind of flips the script a bit. So this is a great time. I love talking to other podcasters because we all like share the same challenges, right? When we're doing the podcast, it's a lot of work, isn't it?
Oh, it is a huge, people don't realize it. No. I think there's a whole group of people out there that think, you know, we just get on and make it happen. And it's not the case. I mean, I'm the amount of research that goes into each guest. You know, I'm grateful for having an awesome producer who does so much in terms of outreach and research, but there's a lot of research that goes into each guest so that conversation can be framed and then they're comfortable being on the show. And
agreed. Then all the post-production and all that after.
That's a whole nother topic, crazy. Right? There's a lot of post-production that's involved with it. And there's, you know, especially, you know, we've had almost 150 guests on Security Conference.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
All kinds of people from one of the guys leading Google's cybersecurity efforts to Oracle's cloud security expert to, you know, should say white hats like yourself, CIA analysts, a Navy targeter, to a laughter yoga coach, some New York Times best-selling authors, you name it.
Wow.
We've all the who's who of cybersecurity has been on, but unless you understand that guest context, it's really hard to do a good interview. It's just
really is. Well, congratulations. That is a just extraordinary amount of guests that you've had from varied industries and personalities. That's just really awesome. So congrats on that.
Hey, thank you, Tom. Thank you. This is a passion for us, so we enjoy it. So speaking of passions, obviously cybersecurity is a passion for you, and I'm sure it wasn't always the case. So who the heck is Tom? We'd love to get your origin story. You know, how did you get sucked into the black hole of cybersecurity?
It was quite the journey for sure. I was I grew up as an 80s kid, you know, kind of dabbling in video games and, you know, early computers, you know, social engineering my parents to get me a computer. My first computer was an Apple IIe. So I was started out as kind of the very young Apple fanboy and convincing them that I needed a second phone line so I could start this thing called a BBS. So a bulletin board system for those of you that may be a little younger than me or us may not remember
people
that technology.
I take it you had the touch tone phone that you picked up and you called and you put it onto the modem when it went.
Yeah. 2,400 baud, baby. I mean, we were screaming fast back then. You know, getting up to that 56K was like lightning speed at the time. And this was even before like America Online and all the big ISPs came out. And so I started my own BBS, and that was my first kind of foray into this kind of world, this underground world of hacking, because there were people that were trying to essentially break into my bulletin board system. You know, one person at a time could connect through my phone line, but still I had interesting people connecting to my BBS, trying to do things that I thought were a little shady. So this was also the time when people were trading, you know, they call them wares, right? Crack software and those types of things of very early computer games, those text-based games. I mean, I think I remember what Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy was like one of the popular ones out there. And, you know, and people were trading this information. And I kind of got interested in like, what is going on? Like, why are people doing these kind of things? And I learned about freaking, so phone freaking. So we're going way back to the old
Kevin Mitnick. You might want to explain that to the audience. That's a term that a lot of people won't understand, but go ahead.
Yeah, phone freaking is where you could basically bypass the tolls that you would be charged on a payphone or a regular phone to make long-distance phone calls. So you would play a series of tones with essentially a box that would trick the phone system into bypassing those restrictions. So this was very early stuff.
People don't remember. Most of the audience probably has never paid for a long-distance phone
call. Nope, they don't do that anymore. So, you know, that was kind of my childhood. And I was always the type that I liked electronics. I liked taking things apart. I liked, fixing things. I was really into, building my own computers and things like that. I spent some time in the military. So I was in the Marine Corps for 4 years. And then when I got out, I went to college. I started, learning more about kind of the fundamentals of information technology. Computer security really wasn't even a thing yet. That wasn't until years later getting into that stuff. And I remember seeing War Games and like, wow, that is the basics of what we consider hacking today. And that really kind of inspired me. And then when I got out of the military, it was, I'm going to go to school. I'm going to learn everything I can about computer technology and networking and all of those things. And like I said, security wasn't a thing yet, even though it was a great interest of mine, because I always knew, okay, if I'm building something like a network, I always thought about how can I break that network? Like, how can I make it not work anymore? And I was pretty good at that, of like, well, I'll just pull this cable out, or I'll just, do this or do that. But then you think about, how is someone with malicious intent going to break this network? And that's where you start thinking of, okay, well, what are the vulnerabilities? And I ended up getting a job at a real estate company in Cleveland here. And I had to hire an individual to do a penetration test. And I had really no idea what a penetration test was, except for I heard about this, people that were really good at this kind of thing called hacking would go to this conference in Las Vegas every year called DEF CON. And I'm like, what do you mean? These hackers get together and they learn about breaking, isn't that like illegal? Like, how is that even legal, right? And we hired this company. And I remember having that conversation with the pen tester about DEF CON and about this whole hacker culture. And I was so enamored by this guy who was just sitting next to me, and I'm watching him just use these tools. And literally he had compromised the entire company's network in about 5 minutes. And I'm like, how the heck did you do that? That is amazing. And I'm just like, tell me about the tools. Tell me about the techniques. And I'm just learning from this guy, and he's showing me like how he's doing it. And I was at the time the person that was patching all of our server infrastructure. I was like the Active Directory administrator. I was doing all that kind of work. So I understood the basics of, okay, this is how you build a system. This is how you defend a system from attackers, by patching the system, configuring it correctly, those types of things. But then I saw him break all of the things that I implemented, and I'm like, wow, this is even more interesting than being the guy patching the servers. So how do I get into this business? And that's what really set me into a direction of, I want to go to DEF CON. I want to learn more and start networking with people that are in this industry. And, how could I become a penetration tester? And so after that, I started looking for, another role that was more focused on pen testing. So I worked for a bank. I got a job on their vulnerability management team. And that was exciting for me because I got experience on an enterprise level of, you know, how does a big financial institution do security? And I had some opportunities to be more of like an apprentice to some of the more senior people on the team. And so I was able to kind of ride along to some of the pen tests that they were doing. And before you know it, after about a year, they're asking me, hey, you know, you've got some talent, you're doing some cool stuff. Do you want to be on the team? And so I became part of that security assessment team for the bank. And I spent almost 5 years there really learning about, you know, different technologies, breaking that technologies, got to do some cool stuff with ATMs and some, you know, really exciting things for me when I was younger that gave me a lot of experience. And, you know, after spending time in the bank, I decided, you know, I want to learn things outside of just this one single environment. So I made the decision to go into consulting. And as you know, in consulting, you get to see the good, the bad, the really ugly, and everything in between. And as a consultant, that's really where I think my career went to the next level, because I had that exposure to different clients, networks, small companies, big companies, everything. It was also my first real introduction into management. So I wasn't really doing pen testing anymore. And that was a big change for me. And I talk to people all the time, like that is the biggest career jump you can make of, hey, I'm no longer technical. I'm now in a leadership position. How do I give all of that up? And that was tough. That was a really hard thing for me to give up, but I did it. And that's kind of where I'm at today now. After Veracode, I went to Bishop Fox, and wow. I'm currently at Bishop Fox, where I'm the VP of consulting and our Cosmos attack surface management product. So I run all of the operations for both those sides of the businesses. And, you know, while I'm not technical anymore, I love the leadership and management aspect of my job. I think leading people has even more challenges than the technical side of the business, but I'd also say it's much more rewarding because I really enjoy seeing the people that work for me do amazing things with their careers. And that's my job. My job is to make them better at doing their job. And I think it's the most rewarding time in my career is doing that role.
Oh, so you've had a heck of a journey.
It's been crazy.
And there are, it's interesting that you say that your primary responsibility is to help other people do better at what they're doing. And that is kind of the hallmark of a really good leader or manager, because it's really easy to criticize people.
Totally.
It's really easy to, you know, berate them or, you know, fire them or whatever, but that's not leadership.
No.
Leadership is trying to help them find their potential, their full potential.
That's right. And I've had my share of bad managers and leaders. I think we all have. And so you take a lot of those lessons, right, of the bad experiences, and you say to yourself, you know, I never want to be that way. And how can I be better than that? And, but I've also had just amazing leaders as well. So I've seen, and just being in as long in this industry as I have, I think you really see those different sides. And that's kind of how I've become who I am today, was from both of those experiences, the good and bad.
So given you've been in this game so long, I have to ask, you're probably immensely familiar with TCP/IP and its packet structure and how it was developed originally at DARPA to, you know, have that, how the protocol functions. Do you see what was done? Security was not at the top of mind when that was developed, right? It was about resilience in the event of a total carnage situation,
right? Yes.
Right. So that our commands would always, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's what I understand it to be.
Yeah.
Our commands would always go to the right places, irrespective.
Right.
Would you have done something differently, hindsight being 2020, with that protocol itself that might have made us a much more safer world. So I know that's asking, a loaded question.
Yeah.
I'm just curious on your, and I wouldn't ask it if you weren't the kid of the 80s, right?
Yeah. So boy, that's a good one. Would I redesign the internet? I don't know if we would know any better, right? Like, because like you said, like going back to DARPA, like the reason the internet was created, it was a military, it was a, you know, it was all about nuclear war, right? Communication, right. In case everything went to hell, how would we run the government? How would we run all those things? I don't know if anybody thought of what we see the internet today is and how embedded it is in our lives. I don't know if anyone could have predicted that. Like that, like I don't, you'd have to be a fortune teller, and even fortune tellers probably got that wrong, right? No. Could you imagine like AI, like where we're at today? Like, I don't even know if it's even fathomable back in the 80s.
You know, I was at a conference this morning, Tom. And it was at a banking conference, and an economist was telling us about what that he thinks there will be a contraction looking out in the future in the job market because of AI, right? It's going to replace a lot of people. I'm with you. I don't think we have even lit the candle of imagination on what a transformation this is going to be. It, to me, it's similar to you. If you remember, turn back the clock in history to the early 1900s. The Boilermakers Union was one of the largest unions in the country. And could those people imagine that that would not even exist as a profession anymore? Right. And how transformative transportation would become. What would be the... I think it's a similar thing. I think we're going to, this is not going to be a gradual change. It's going to be a transformation. And we don't know what that's going to look like.
Yeah. The Industrial Revolution, go all the way back in history. And I think people had that same mindset. Like, why would this change? We're always going to be doing it this way. Or, we really don't know the future. And, I think we're in that stage right now with AI. I mean, I think we have our best guess of what might happen, but we really don't know. But I think we're all in agreement that we don't want it to be, Skynet from the Terminator movies. we don't want that to happen, but honestly, we don't know. No one can predict that, but I don't think going back to, would we change anything about how the internet was designed? I don't think so. I think that was just the natural evolution of things.
Yeah, I would agree. Thank you for that answer.
Sure.
It was a little bit off to the side, but I'm always curious for someone else, because I grew up in the 80s in Cleveland.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. Very cool.
Yeah. Willoughby, Ohio.
Okay. All right. You're on the east side.
Yes.
I'm on the west side. So Avon Lake.
There you go. Yeah, I was, I grew up there. I'm not there anymore, but yes, that was way back when. I remember that era quite well. And when you look at War Games, I guess that gets to, that movie was probably one of the first that talked about hacking and what the potential liabilities could be of it. And now today, fast forward, have the methods really changed that much than what was depicted from back then?
No. The short answer is no. No.
That's what I thought. I mean, yeah.
It's fascinating to me. I mean, we obviously have more tools, there's more techniques, there's a lot more information being shared. I mentioned this to a few other interviews I've been in. This is the golden age of training. Like, I've never seen so much training available for people, not just paid, but for free. Like, go on YouTube and there's so many people giving training about how to be a hacker, how to be a pen tester, how to do this and that. And we never had that kind of growing up in the industry. And it's fascinating to me that when you take all of that away, it still gets down to the basics of, how do you find a vulnerability? How do you exploit that vulnerability? And then what do you do with it? after? And how do you gain access to data? And how do you exfiltrate that data? That's it. That is the same stuff they've been doing back in the 80s, back in even before computers. Like, it's the basis of theft, right? Is. Any kind of theft.
I'm so glad you said that. And to me, it's, if I was to even generalize it further, it's about looking at a process that you want to compromise. Mm-hmm. And then you meticulously test every facet of that process until you find that. Finding that vulnerability, to me, is where the genius lies.
Yes. I agree.
Right.
I agree. And analyzing that process to find what can be manipulated or what can be broken. And that's really where the critical thinking comes into play, right? It's not just about running a tool and then, oh, look, I found something and then exploiting it. It's actually taking a step back and understanding, well, how did that vulnerability get there in the first place? How is the system configured? What are the steps? You know, always work backwards, right? To think about the overarching environment, the network, like what led to that. And so this is why I tell people, like, it's very important to have that defensive mindset as a pen tester. And some of the best pen testers I've worked with actually started off as blue teamers or developers or people that were builders, because they have that mindset and they can think about how the system was built. And then it makes you a better offensive security professional, because now you know, well, I know how it's built and now I can break it. And you can really have that mindset when you're doing penetration testing. Really makes you really good at your job.
So, Tom, it brings up something in what you just stated, that why is it, and I'd like to get your opinion on it, why is it that after the fact, so when a software is put to the market or a piece of hardware is launched into the market, the hacking community ends up doing a much better job of QA testing that piece of technology than the OEM themselves? Mm-hmm. Is there something broken in our hardware and software development cycle that is letting a lot of things creep in the first place?
Yeah. I mean, the short answer of it is security is hard. And security, good security, costs money, time, and effort, and people. And if you don't have a good balance of all of those things, it's very hard to ship something. And I hate saying completely secure, because there's nothing that is completely secure. That is, everything is vulnerable and everything is hackable. You just need time, money, and people. ask any nation state and they'll tell you. But, of course. I think it really, it's so interesting because, companies struggle with this because, it's not like they're not making an effort. You know, you could have the best security team in the world, the most talented, and throw tons of money at it. And then some, guy doing bug bounty is going to find some critical vulnerability that just gets missed. And it's nobody's fault. It just gets missed. So everything comes down to risk for a company, right? So they're doing a risk assessment. They're doing the best that they can. And they're, the business is there to make money. So they've got to ship it and they've got to get it out the door. But that's why you can't rely 100% on just your internal team or your, whatever you're doing for compliance and so on. You have to rely on other individuals like bug bounty and third-party testing and other things to supplement the stuff that you're doing internally in a company. It can't all be you. Right? This is definitely a team effort. And that's what I tell people, because this is hard. Security is very hard, even in the best run security teams and programs.
It is absolutely very hard. I concur wholeheartedly. It's not for the faint of heart. And the adversary is not your run-of-the-mill thief, even though they might be using the process of age-old process of theft. I mean, mm-hmm. these are people that are very technical. They're extremely intelligent.
Yes. Yes. And often they're funded by, you know, organized crime and large governments, and they have the, you know, unlimited capabilities often that we don't as, you know, white hats, you know, security people working for companies.
So let me, what are your thoughts? Do you, you know, most companies that are investing heavily into cybersecurity, their primary business is not cybersecurity. They do whatever they do, whatever widget they make or service they provide, they do. Do you think cybersecurity adds value to their market offering? Or do they, have they ever thought of how do you use cybersecurity to create value in their market offering to where it is not a cost center and bound by, you know, well, this is your budget, this is all we can do, but it's actually looked at as a potential source of revenue. Have you seen anything on that?
Yeah, you know, that's interesting. I think we're going to start seeing more of that with some of the recent things I've seen. If you heard about the new, that Biden security, cybersecurity initiative around light labeling of IoT devices. Right now it's voluntary, and I know that all this is just starting to get kicked off. But that alone, allowing companies to opt in and say, hey, I've tested, I've used this third party or whatever the program says I'm using to test the security of this device and product that you, the consumer, are using, I think is going to go a long way to validate that, hey, the money we're spending on security is actually help us sell more products, because now this is now endorsed by the government. Just like we do with nutrition labeling of food, it's going to be very similar, I think, in some ways. And the more that companies can kind of advertise, look, we are doing good security. A great example of that is two-factor authentication. Like every company should be using two-factor authentication for their customers, right? It's a you have to these days, right?
But how many actually are?
But I know, but they should be proactive and say to their customers, hey, we want you to enable two-factor authentication, or we're going to enable this for your protection because we know hackers go after your credentials, instead of the conversation like 23andMe just had where they blamed the victims, you know, saying, well, it's your fault because you used a weak password. Like, we have to stop doing that as an industry, right? We can't blame the users anymore. Like, companies are just as fault for not helping customers select and choose good passwords and enables good controls like two-factor authentication. So, so to answer your question, I think, yes, I think it's going to start to change with things like the government kind of, you know, initiatives that are help pushing this. And that's a real positive step to actually see the government do something positive for a change. So we'll see how where that goes, but I'm optimistic.
Which initiatives in particular do you think?
I think a lot of the things that we're seeing from CISA that are coming out recently, like I said, the labeling program. Yep. Is one, I think it's called the trust mark, I think it was called.
Okay.
That's the one where IoT devices can now opt in. So manufacturers can opt in to have these labels if they go through a security testing program, which is still yet to be defined. But I know there are groups, I've been involved with a group called the IOXT, which has set standards around product security for consumer devices. So wireless devices, Fitbits, Apple Watches, all those types of things. So I would suspect groups like that are going to be, you know, assisting the government with those programs. But I've really been impressed with a lot of the things that CISA's been doing, you know, a lot of the awareness campaigns and other things that they're working with companies. I'm also a big fan of like InfraGuard, you know, where companies can partner with the FBI to trade information and techniques and intel and things like that are also very valuable. So I hope to see a lot more positive things like that with the government in the future.
That's really good. What about the Hack Back program? What do you think about that, the proposal that the Biden administration had?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. you know, has its challenges for sure. But, you know, I look at it too, like when the government started getting into bug bounty, right? Like all the initiatives that, if you know, Katie Mazouras, for, you know, when she was at Microsoft, and she pioneered all of the, what bug bounty is today. And it was so interesting to see how the government had changed their views. I'm like, we're not going to let anybody hack the Pentagon. That's crazy talk. Like, and coming from the 80s, right? That is like, nope, you're going to jail. You're going to be just like, yep, Kevin Mitnick, right? In jail. And, you know, nowadays, the Pentagon has their own bug bounty program. They will let you hack the Pentagon legally. Like, that's just amazing to hear about that now.
You know, it's not a bad idea. You know, state of Ohio, the Secretary of State's office actually puts that on their homepage.
Yeah. Yeah.
As long as you share the vulnerabilities that you found,
mm-hmm,
there's no charges that they're going to press. Now, I've never tested it, so I don't know if that's, do you first go in handcuffs and then you get a get out of jail free card? I mean, what exactly is the process for this? I don't know. But that's there. And you look at the bug bounty, mm-hmm, program. Here's the thing. If you don't disclose it, you get paid more money.
Right.
Right. So if you find a vulnerability in, mm-hmm, iOS or Windows that's exploitable, heck, it even maybe one of our own three-letter agencies that might pay you a little more money than the bug bounty program does.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's like I said, like today, like this day and age is much more friendly to hacking, penetration testing. It's not so, you know, you do this, you go to jail, it's against the law. I mean, yes, of course, there are still federal laws and you can still go to jail. And we've had all kinds of interesting cases over the last several years of, you know, pen testers. I think there was a consulting firm, if you remember this, where they did a physical pen test of a federal courthouse. And pen tester was arrested by the police, and he was actually in jail for like a couple days. And the judge actually wanted to charge this person with a felony, even though he had full permission from the court, full permission from everybody to do this. The judge was just so adamant that this should be legal, you know, hiring a penetration tester to break into a facility, that he should just go to jail. And they had to go to court. They had to get lawyers. They had to go through all of this. And you'll still have people with that mindset of, listen, this is actually a career. This is what people do. And we're actually doing it to make your security better. But there's some people that just have that mindset.
And what does that judge say to a foreign actor who's flipping him the bird, saying, yeah, go ahead. You want to arrest me? Try it.
Right. It's just a very short-sighted view of the world, frankly.
So who would you rather have? Somebody who's friendly, who's telling you what's broken.
Right.
Or would you rather that all your data and all your secrets be out on the web by some third party that you have no control over?
Exactly. Yeah. Pick one.
Pick one. I mean, that kind of thinking just seems that it seems crazy. So, and it's the same thing with bug bounty. I think they should up the bounty. You know,
I agree.
If someone's willing to pay you $1 million for a vulnerability that you find, then the bug bounty guy should come to the table, mm-hmm, with a million simoleons and say, hey, look, tell us what it is. But it's a double-edged sword, because the agencies of every nation also want access to those vulnerabilities, because they're using them.
Yes, they do.
On a regular basis for whatever. Some people may consider it nefarious intent. Other may consider it, well, it's just spying. It's the age-old craft.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Cyber war. You know, we've been in a cyber war, I think, ever since, you know, computers really came into existence, especially with networking and, you know, telecommunications advancements and modems and all the things that we've seen evolve over the years. And it's only going to get worse, right? Like, you know, nation states are always going to be spying on each other. And, you know, it's going to be interesting to see what happens in the next 5 to 10 years, I think, are going to be more interesting.
So, Tom, what have you seen as some misconceptions from people about, you know, offensive security, the capability of hackers and, you know, I'm never going to get hacked or that really can't happen? Like, do you have some real examples or things that you've seen out there, your pet favorite ones that are just greatly misconceptions about the offensive world of penetration?
Yeah, I think, you know, oftentimes pen testers get a bad rap sometimes of, I've had situations, well, I mean, when I was a pen tester myself, I have accidentally taken down systems that either were out of scope or I didn't know that they should have been out of scope or the client didn't tell me that they should be out of scope. I remember taking down a mainframe at a small bank for a couple minutes, and a couple minutes can cost a bank a lot of money. So that was an interesting conversation with a client. And it was something that I, of course, didn't intentionally do. It just happened over the course of the work that I was doing. And through an NMAP scan, basically a port scan, took down an old mainframe, which honestly is a vulnerability in itself, because a simple scan shouldn't necessarily take down a bank's mainframe, which I made that argument. But again, you know, it is my fault. It was my fault. You know, you apologize, you move on. But I think a lot of times it's interesting when a pen tester is on the network, they're doing an authorized assessment, and then any little thing that goes wrong in the company, like that day, that week, they're like, oh, it's the pen tester. It's got to be the pen tester's fault, right? Can't be anything else. Can't be another outage. Can't be anything. It's the pen tester's fault. So sometimes, you know, we take a lot of heat for the work we do because it's inherently dangerous, right? And maybe systems do go down. We don't plan for that. We do our best to not cause a disruption, but it does happen. And I've seen kind of every aspect of what can happen. And when money's involved, people get a little upset when a company can't make money because of something that you did. So that's why I tell people, be very careful with your scope of work, with the tools, the techniques that you're using, because they could cause something inadvertently to happen.
And, you know, you just pointed out something with money here. There's a reason why a lot of companies, why vulnerability management is absolutely a loss situation for any provider. Yeah. You lose on all fronts. If you patch a system and it shuts down the revenue stream, because none of us really know how a company makes money. You know, we don't know how their economic engine is working. You shut down something that makes them money, and now you're on the hook for that, right? Yeah. They're like, well, we're supposed to patch these. Well, you didn't tell us we couldn't patch it. So yeah, it's one of the legal reasons why you don't see a lot of companies offering patch management.
Right. Right. Yeah, it gets into like legacy systems too. Like there are systems in a large company that remain unpatched, untouched, because they are so critical to how that business makes money that they're just going to leave it alone. And it's so running like Windows NT4. Yeah.
How do you secure that environment, Tom? I mean, there's still, like you mentioned, a bank. There's a lot of banks that still have mainframes.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
How do you secure an environment? And let's not pick on a bank. Why don't we pick on a manufacturer with a robot?
Mm-hmm.
And that robot was a Windows 95, runs off a Windows 95 machine, and it doesn't take any updates. And yep. I'm not making this story up.
I don't believe it. Yeah.
Right. But it's on the network. It hasn't had a security update in 25 years. God knows how long, whenever Windows 95 was out.
Yeah.
And they don't want to upgrade the robot because that's a multi-million dollar capital cost, which is logical. I mean, it's like, you want me to update my robot, which makes the widgets that I make money off of, and it does a good job of it. So you're asking me to fix what's not broken. How do you secure that environment? What do you do?
Well, I'd make the argument that a lot of attackers may not even know what to do if they saw a Windows 95 system to attack, so because it's so old. But you know, regardless, you're right. I mean, I think it is. You know, we talk about getting back to basics a lot in security, right? Like network segmentation. I can't tell you how many times we still run into clients that don't have their network segmented. Like we run into a flat network in this day and age. It still happens. And so we have to get back to the basics of cybersecurity. You know, the CIA triad, you know, from our CISSP training, like literally like network segmentation for your legacy systems, whether that's virtual, physical, however you want to do it. Now with the cloud, you know, there's so many different ways to properly segment a network and do it easily. It is all available to people to do. But again, it's that mindset of, well, I haven't thought about that because why would I want to segment a network? Who's going to attack my robot with that makes my widgets? You know, no one has told them how vulnerable they are. No one has told them, here's the threats against your business. And they just don't understand that. So why would they spend money to upgrade their robot?
That's,
you know, and that gets into conversations with the board. How seriously does the company want to take security? And that's the great thing about red teaming, about pen testing, is that that's what we provide, is we provide that shock and awe of what could happen if you don't take security seriously, especially red teaming. I mean, that is what a red team is meant to do. Test your defenses. This is why I tell people all the time, like most organizations are not ready for a red team. You have to have a very mature security program to be ready for a red team. And I get annoyed when I hear a lot of people calling everything a red team. Oh, that app pen test, that's a red team. You know, this is a red team, that is a red team. No, it's not. A red team is a very specific threat emulation exercise targeting an organization that has the controls in place and the maturity to understand what that red team engagement is going to provide to them. So I honestly think it's a lot just a lack of education of why companies don't do the basics.
Yes, lack of awareness. And then having the personnel on board that can competently guide you through the exercise. Right,
that's hard.
And that has nothing to do with tech. The exercise you're talking about is sitting around a table.
Yes. And one of the things I've seen a lot more success with is tabletop exercises. I find these extremely valuable to an organization because there is no testing involved. There's no pen tester sitting there attacking your network, but they are conversations with the key people in your organization about how you're going to respond to an attack. How are you going to handle a ransomware incident? Do you have the right people, the policies, the procedures all in place? And you should really be having that conversation before you even touch the network, before you even have a pen tester on site or anything like that. Those exercises are extremely valuable. And the other thing I mentioned too is like purple team type of engagements where, you know, you're methodically testing controls, working with your blue team, seeing if they see things in the logs, going back and forth with the testers, learning, adjusting systems. That has so much more value than just saying, yeah, I want you guys to send your best red team at me, throw the kitchen sink at me, break into my buildings, do all these things. Like, and that's great and everything. But at the end of the day, if you haven't even had the conversations of how you're going to secure your entire organization and how you're going to respond to an attack, it makes the red team kind of just worthless at that point.
What do you think about automated pen testing tools? What's your opinion of that?
I have a lot of opinions on automated pen testing.
I think to ask the question.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is kind of vendor FUD, to be honest. A lot of marketing, you know, vendors really like to capitalize on the marketing aspect, especially now with AI. Everything is AI powered. Everything is AI enabled, automated. And I haven't seen any true automated pen test solution that actually works the way they say it works without having a human behind the scenes or behind the curtain kind of pulling the strings. So, and I'm not going to call out any vendors in particular, but
there's a whole bunch in the market.
There's a lot. There's a lot. And I'm not discounting the tech. I'm not discounting the hard work that a lot of these, you know, engineers and people are developing this tech. I mean, it's amazing. I will agree with them on that. But it is not yet going to replace the human aspect that is so needed in penetration testing. Not anytime soon, even with all the AI that we have. And I'm a big proponent of AI. I think AI has a lot of benefits for not just our industry, but the world as well. But I think it is a way for, it's an assistant, right? It's to help do our jobs better. I don't necessarily agree with it's going to just replace you as a human being and you're, you know, we're all going to be like, remember the movie WALL-E where we're just sitting around and just like drinking Coke and, you know, scooting around on a chair all day. Like I don't think that's the future of the human. But I do think that the future of our industry too will be augmented with automation, but yes. I don't think it's going to replace us.
No, I think, you know, everything up the knowledge curve just shifts further to the right. You know, that's so there'll be jobs that, you know, I could see a day when you don't need a lot of coding. You could you could get AI to write you, hey, write me Space Invaders. People probably don't know what that is. But, here's a game.
and it
could probably get you 90% of the way there. Mm-hmm. But you'll still need people to do oversight. You're going to need people to do architecture.
Yes.
That's something I think anywhere conscious thought is required. I think that's where AI does fall off the bus. And there's a big difference between AI, which is pattern behavior.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
And repeating what's already been done versus
conscious
cognitive function to create something unique.
Right.
That is specific for a situation.
And I think that's where a lot of these vendors kind of fall off is a lot of them are saying, our solution is going to fix all of your problems in an organization. And based on my experience and the experience of others in the industry, everybody's security program is different. There is unique aspects about every single program. One size does not fit all. And you can't just, you know, say, yep, we have everything for you. Just buy our stuff and it will fix all your problems. That is not the reality at all.
I'm glad you said it. You're now maybe the 100th guest to say something.
So it's almost like we're on to something.
maybe people might get a clue now. Hey, Tom, we're at the hour. I want to make sure we give you some time to plug anything you'd like to plug and tell our audience about anything you want to talk about.
So awesome.
The floor is yours for that.
Well, thanks. The only plug I'd have is if you're looking for another security podcast to check out, you can check out my podcast, Shared Security. So that's sharedsecurity.net. You can find us wherever you like to listen to podcasts. And we're also on YouTube as well. So you can just look up Shared Security there. So both have the audio and the video version of the podcast. We've been podcasting for 14 years. So every week. And
it's awesome.
It's been fun. It's a labor of love, but yeah, come check us out. We talk about the news. We talk about just different things going on in the industry, and hopefully you can leave with a couple tips and tricks too. So
that's great. Hey, send us a link. We can put links in the show notes.
Awesome.
Too,
thank you.
Like. That is not a problem. It's a small community.
It is. It is.
And we're all trying to do some very similar things. So that's great. Are you making any appearances? Are you talking anywhere?
I'll be at the RSA conference, but not speaking at RSA, but I will be there in attendance. So if anybody wants to meet up, I will be there the week of RSA. Yep.
What's the best way to get a hold of you if they want to?
Best way is, you know, either on Twitter or X now. X, Twitter, same thing, right? Agent0x0 is my handle. Also on LinkedIn, you can hit me up there. Or through my website through the podcast, sharedsecurity.net.
That's fantastic. Well, Tom, it's been a real pleasure having you on the show. Thank you so much. We look forward to at some point having you back.
Yeah.
And going into different areas. You know, we barely touched any of the questions. We
discussed. That's right.
Thank you so much.
Awesome. Well, thank you for having me.